Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Several months ago, I was just hanging with my friend, Dr. Brian Bowdle. Dr. Bowdle is a professor here at the Grand Valley State University, and he is a psychology teacher. And we were just talking about the kinds of things that guys normally talk about, you know, the meaning of life, that sort of thing. He asked me if I'd ever read a book called The Birth and Death of Meaning by Ernest Becker. I said no. So he gave me a copy, and I was so impressed with this book, and I felt that it really connected with a lot of the things that we speak about here on Common Threads. I thought, you know, this is worth a show. So I invited Brian to be here, and lo and behold, he is here today. We had a few false starts, but you know what? It doesn't matter. This is not timely information. Brian, as I mentioned, is a psychology professor here at Grand Valley. Formerly, he was at Indiana University and has made Grand Rapids his home for the past several years. So we welcome to Common Threads, Brian Bowdle. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Certainly. I remember our conversation. This is a few months ago, and you just said, here, you need to read this book. So I did, and I was very impressed with it, as I said. And this is a book that you use in one of your classes, correct?
That's correct. One of the classes that I teach on a regular basis, and it's probably my favorite class to teach, is the psychology capstone. Probably every department at GVSU, most departments at universities around the country, have some kind of capstone course for their majors. In the psych department, several instructors, myself included, teach this course, different sections of it. We're given a fair amount of leeway in terms of how we want to teach it, what our central focus is going to be. There are certain things that all of us need to do for our senior students before they graduate with their psych degrees. But right from the beginning, I decided that I wanted to have a fairly broad but meaningful central focus, that being the relationship, the dynamics between self and society, between the individual and the collective, so to speak. And throughout the course, in roughly historical order, cover a number of different major theoretical perspectives on the human condition, going all the way back to Sigmund Freud and his 1930 book, Civilization and Its Discontents, but then every couple weeks moving forward a little bit. The students at first are shocked that I oftentimes assign them about 10 books to read during the course of the semester, and many of those books change each time that I teach it as I get interested in new things, discover new perspectives coming out. But there are always two or three books that I've maintained in this course. The first one, of course, being Freud's Civilization as Discontents, the second one being a book called Walden 2. By B.F. Skinner, very interesting sort of utopian vision of society.
I interviewed him years ago, by the way.
Did you really?
I did.
Okay.
It was really a fascinating conversation. That probably doesn't surprise you.
No, it doesn't. he's a very interesting, I think, very misunderstood psychologist.
Yes.
But very, very optimistic always, his outlook for the human condition.
I remember that.
But then the third book that I've always had students read is this one, Birth and Death of Meaning by Ernest Becker. Which came out in 1971. And even though Becker is not a psychologist, he was a cultural anthropologist by training, he always took a keen interest in psychiatry and the psychoanalytic perspective on human nature. And, of course, that comes out through this book. It's a work of existential psychology more than anything else. And I always like introducing the students to this perspective. Many of them have never thought along these lines, but I think it's worth doing before they leave the university and start making their way into the real world, whatever that means.
So the bulk, or perhaps the entirety of the class is made up of psych majors?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So they kind of know what they're getting themselves into at this level. What level is it, 300, 400?
It's a 400 level class. So you have to be a senior to take it. It's meant to be one of the very last classes that you take. So all the students coming in, they've of course had intro, they've had a number of different content courses at the 300, 400 level, they've had their methods and statistics, they know how to read research paper, they're familiar with a lot of the major findings from the different areas. But we try to, all of us in the Capstone, shake them up a little bit, oftentimes get them a little bit out of their comfort zone.
The idea or the memory I have when I took my first psych class many years ago is that some of the people in class were really searching for some sort of meaning. They took psychology almost the same way you might take a theology class.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that in students?
I see it in some students. I don't think that you would find that drive in as many students as you might have 20, let alone 40 years ago. Much of the early work in psychology and psychiatry, of course, stems from the ideas of Sigmund Freud and some of his followers, people like Carl Jung and so on and so forth. Even though nowadays many of these theorists are derided as being unscientific, they were really grappling with big ideas about human existence. They were wide-read. They drew from the humanities. Carl Jung in particular drew from different spiritual and religious writings from around the world. Their ideas, their proposals, I think really did appeal to the type of student that you're describing. Starting in the 1940s and 50s, as behaviorism came to dominate American psychology, and then we had the cognitive revolution that started in the late 50s, 1960s, which really tried to portray the human mind-brain system as being very much like a digital computer. The questions that were being asked were much more scientific. They were much more fine-grained and detailed. I think a lot of very, very sound empirical discoveries were made, but the nature of the questions began to get in many ways smaller and smaller and smaller. And in the view of many people who nowadays consider themselves followers of Becker, more and more trivial when you get right down to it. They dealt less with big scale human motivations and anxieties and goals and desires, and more with just the inner workings of the mind, and more recently, of course, the brain, as neuroscience has come to define more and more sub-areas across the field of psychology. So I think that what happened was that a lot of theorizing, a lot of work in psychology was moving from the big scale, what we might call why-level questions, to questions at the level of what and how. And those are important questions to address in any science. But it's those why-level questions, I think, that are ultimately fascinating. I tend to focus more on those in my Capstone course.
So the kind of student that I remember sitting next to in my early psych classes, and I didn't major mm-hmm. in psychology, you know, but if you had those big why questions, today you move into philosophy or religious studies, right? Would that mm-hmm. be? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that philosophy and theology are the fields right now that are most likely to address those. And sociology still to some extent. But it hasn't been maybe up until the last 10 or 15 years that a growing number of theorists and researchers in the psychological sciences have begun returning these questions and saying, you know what, these are important questions if we really want to understand the human condition. Maybe ultimately psychology can't empirically address all of them, but we need to keep in mind these are the sorts of questions oftentimes that motivate human beings, either consciously or subconsciously, and we would be foolish to completely ignore them just because we don't right now know how to tackle them in a scientific manner.
And deride them as well. Mm-hmm. Certainly psychology has, as a field, a reputation of previously deriding spiritual inquiry.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Freud say that, you know, boy, if we only got rid of religion, we'd have a utopia? Or is that oversimplifying what he said?
It's oversimplifying a little bit. But Freud was a staunch atheist. And if you read some of his later writings, books like Future of an Illusion or, again, Civilization as Discontents, many of the things he said about religion, it wouldn't be surprising to hear those things coming out of the mouth of a person like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris. He seems to very much be a precursor to a lot of their lines of thinking, not quite as harsh as they were. But certainly he was no fan of organized religion and viewed many religious ideas as infantile narcissism, I think was one of his phrases.
So if someone came to Freud saying, okay, here are my problems. This is what I deal with. This is why I'm depressed. And then Freud learns that this person is quite religious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that whether the person was Jewish or Christian, because I'll bet you those are the only people he had to deal with. I doubt he had many Buddhists.
No.
as patients. But would he clearly indicate, do you think, that you need to rid yourself of religion before I can help you? Before,
no.
Oh, he wouldn't do
no,
that?
No, he wouldn't have done that. No. As far as he was concerned, where religion was most useful to people was in terms of giving them a sense of meaning in life. In fact, he believed that the notion of meaning in life largely stood or fell depending on one's religious orientations. He himself believed that life was largely meaningless, that we're basically animals, super smart animals. We have our own drives, most of which we're not consciously aware of, and those being primarily sexual drives and aggressive drives, and really wanted to focus more on those sorts of unconscious urges, unresolved conflicts from the past, anxieties and fixations people might have that they're unaware of. But religion really didn't play much of any role in terms of his psychotherapy. Now, when he started in his later works diagnosing what he thought were the central problems of societies or civilizations or entire cultures, then he became a little more negative about religion, but even he doubted that you could ever truly get rid of religion.
So he wouldn't attempt to rid someone of their religion in hopes to cure them, if you will.
To my knowledge, no. Now, again, he has the writings of Sigmund Freud are vast. I've only scratched the surface in terms of reading some of them, and most of what I've read by Freud I read when I was an undergraduate, these being some of the more famous case studies. But I really don't recall religion being mentioned very prominently in any of those works.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Dr. Brian Bowdle is my guest today, and we're talking about the birth and death of meaning. Now, I was not aware of this book by Ernest Becker that we're talking about today, although our conversation isn't 100% focused on this book, as just evidence in the last 15 minutes. But so many people I know are aware of Viktor Frankl's book,
mm-hmm.
Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
Does this book relate to that? Does it come on the heels of that? Is it inspired by that or not? Do you know?
This book came out after that book. I forget the publication date of that book. But Frankl, of course, writing about, reminiscing about his experiences during the Holocaust in the concentration camps, writing about the individuals who seem to, despite those conditions, thrive and survive versus those who maybe not so much because they were, because they were executed by the Nazis, but seemed to just sort of wither and came to the conclusion that really those who felt that their life had meaning, had purpose, there was something worth living for, even despite all of these tragic surroundings. These were the ones who did well, and I think did a good job of distinguishing between leading a life that was meaningful on the one hand versus a life where you're simply striving to be happy. Not too many people were happy in the concentration camps, but some people did maintain that sense of meaning. Even that sense of meaning thrived under these circumstances, under the adversity. And that book documents that and then goes on to discuss, of course, after he was emancipated and got back into practice and started working, how he translated a lot of those insights into his own therapy and his own visions of what therapy should be all about. I'm actually surprised Ernest Becker doesn't talk about Frankl more in this book.
I was too. I did see it mentioned, but it was just a brief mention.
Yes.
So knowing Viktor Frankl's work and then reading this, does it take Frankl's idea to another level, just the idea of searching for meaning?
I think it does, but in a very, very challenging way. Because Frankl, of course, is talking about how important that sense of meaning, meaning with a capital M, is to a healthy psychological existence and even physiological existence. Ernest Becker believes that too, with all of his heart, that we need to have a sense of meaning and purpose in life. What makes this book a more challenging follow-up is that he then, Becker then deconstructs so many of the things that give so many people a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives, basically tears down a lot of facades and dismisses a lot of illusions, and then leaves us with some questions. Well, now what do we do given that we need meaning and all these things that oftentimes give us meaning are in fact arbitrary, fictitious, false.
But if they are giving someone meaning, what's the difference?
The difference is that many of these things that give us meaning, even though they themselves are false, can lead us into rather neurotic lifestyles at an individual level and can make us behave in very aggressive and even destructive ways towards other people who don't share our fictions.
Give us a couple of examples. I'll bet your religion is in there.
It is, but in some very complicated ways. I think that in order to get into this discussion, we need to backtrack a little bit in terms of some of the ideas that Becker is getting at in the first chapters of his book. Becker was a religious individual, and more so towards the end of his life when he was writing this book and his follow-up book called The Denial of Death, which won the Pulitzer Prize, although that wasn't awarded until just shortly after he had passed away, unfortunately. But towards the beginning of the book, Becker, of course, is trying to discuss what is it that makes humans unique? What is it that makes the human condition unique? He starts with an evolutionary perspective, rather simplified one, but it's not entirely inaccurate, and talks about the fact that, you know, just like all other animals, we have survival instincts. We are basically programmed to survive. We try to avoid pain. We try to avoid threats to our biological existence. But there are a couple of things that make humans very, very different from any other species of animal, at least as far as he's concerned. And these all revolve around our amazing cognitive abilities, abilities that maybe some other species share partially, but certainly don't have to the extent that we do.
I think esteem is one of them.
Esteem comes from all of this. Yes. So one of the first things that he points out is that unlike any other species, again, as far as he knew and as far as many people know to right now, we are a symbolic species. You see that obviously in language. Many animals communicate, but we have language. We have words and if they're written systems, visual symbols. They stand for things. The symbols themselves can be very arbitrary, but they stand for concepts. They relate to concepts that are ways of giving meaning to things in the world around us. We are a symbolic species. We create meanings, and we crave meanings. We even invent meanings when they aren't actually there. And there are many, many examples of that from cognitive psychology where people will perceive things in completely random patterns that actually aren't there. Things that are pure coincidence, we see causality in it. We just seek, we crave meaning. And not just in the world around us, but in our personal lives as well. We want to believe that our own lives are meaningful too, again, with a capital M. The other thing about humans is we are incredibly imaginative, much more so probably than any other species. We can contemplate things that have never existed. We can think about the far distant past, points of time that we never lived in. We can contemplate the future, including past our own lifetimes. What might our grandchildren accomplish with their lives? We can imagine all sorts of things. And these imaginative capabilities have enabled us to create, invent all sorts of wonderful things and overcome so many challenges that without imagination we couldn't. But that imagination has a downside too. Part of it involves self-awareness. We use ourselves as conceptual, cognitive, cultural reference points. The downside of this imagination, the self-awareness, is we probably more than any other species are aware of the fact that someday we will die. individually. Each one of us is going to pass away. There's no way around that. And this creates a sort of anxiety that presumably most other species don't have, at least not to this extent. On the one hand, we all realize, especially, you know, if we have grown up in a relatively healthy way, that we're all special, we're all unique, we're wonderful, we have many, many potentials. But at the same time, eventually, this has all got to come to an end. This is what Becker and others have called the paradox of individuality within finitude. It's one of the basic existential anxieties he writes about. Yes, we're a symbolic species. We crave meaning. We create meaning. We want to believe that our lives are meaningful. We also have certain anxieties that stem from our amazing abilities to contemplate ourselves, our existence here on the face of the planet Earth, and what its limitations are. But above all, according to Becker, you know, what we're really uncomfortable with is the notion that we're just animals. Because we're symbolic, because we want to believe that we have purpose, because we have such incredible imagination, anything that reminds us that we could be mere animals, that and that includes the fact that we eventually will die, that perhaps just like many other animals, according to many people, our lives really don't have that much meaning, anything that reminds us of this biological nature is threatening to people to different extents in different ways.
Thank you. No, that's a brilliant explanation. Taking it a step further then, we need to search for meaning, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And to summarize what you said, or summarize what Becker says, is that we look to things that are false, fictitious. All right.
Right.
Now, that's one thing that you didn't quite mention.
No, I haven't gotten to that yet.
Man, okay.
This is where I think this book becomes really interesting, because what Becker's really asking two big questions in here. Number one, why are humans so concerned with self-esteem? Why do we seem to crave self-esteem? Why do we need to achieve it, maintain it, maybe even boost it? But why is this so important to us? He goes on to claim throughout the second half of the book that more so than sex or aggression or anything that Freud and his followers wrote about, that self-esteem may be the dominant motive of human beings.
Now, do we share any of that with lower animals? For instance, what about two lions mm-hmm. who fight each other to be the king of the pride?
Right.
Is that esteem-oriented, or is it purely evolutionary? Does it take the stronger lion to be the king of the pride? You see what I'm saying?
It's a great question. We do see in many animal species a striving for dominance, especially if you're talking about animals that organize themselves in packs or herds or tribes. Oftentimes there is a dominance hierarchy or a pecking order, so to speak. I suspect very strongly that these drives are instinctual in these animals. But at the same time, as we're talking about maybe more and more complex species cognitively, that striving for dominance to be the alpha male in many species or the alpha female in some species, bonobos, for instance, probably becomes tied into some more complex social behaviors and some fairly rudimentary forms of self-awareness. We're only beginning to really realize just how self-aware some other species may be, much more so than Becker suspected. I think that, you know, the higher primates certainly have some self-awareness. Elephants almost certainly do.
Absolutely.
Probably some of the more complex marine mammals do. None of these species have anything like a cumulative cultural system that like humans do. But these species do have their own fairly set forms of what we might call primitive cultures. And I think self-awareness is part of that. So I don't think the divide between humans and all other animals is as rigid, as black and white as Becker makes it out to be. But his thinking is very much reflecting the evolutionary thinking of the time that this book was published.
Did I read in here that he claims animals have no memory?
I believe he says something to that extent, yes.
Then why does why do both of my cats, when they see the carrier pulled out, which means only one thing, the annual trip to the vet, why do they freak out? They haven't seen that carrier in a year.
Well, once again, I think that, that Becker does downplay the psychological capacities of many, many animals. When he says that, and again, I'm thinking back to how exactly he put this, but to the extent that he claimed that other animals really don't have memory, I think that he's talking about particular types of memory. In psychology, distinctions are made between all sorts of forms of memory. So there's semantic memory, memory for concepts and word meanings and things like that. And arguably, humans excel above all other animals when it comes to that. There's also what's sometimes called a procedural memory. And this has to do with memory of how to do different motor skills, for instance. And all animals have that sort of a thing. Certainly, there's a type of memory that stems from conditioning, whether it's classical conditioning or operant conditioning. Thinking about what the behaviors we're studying, all animals have that. Even amoebas develop that kind of memory. And then, of course, you have episodic and autobiographical memory. What you're talking about with your cats, you could say maybe that's simple conditioned memory. They've come to associate that with bad experiences, but it could be episodic as well.
Well, thank you, Brian. Brian, we're out of time right now, but this is a great conversation. Please come back next week. We'll
continue. I would love to. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Brian Bowdle, who is a professor of psychology here at Grand Valley State University. We're talking about The Birth and Death of Meaning, an Interdisciplinary Perspective on the Problem of Man, a book written by Ernest Becker back in the 70s. Join us again next week here on WGVU.